Right, there we go. Well, why don't I know you sent me a lot, and I
Yeah, I
didn't
wasn't
do a
expecting you to read. It just seemed like the quickest way for you to get a sense of where I'm coming from. You know, like I said, you read one or two and you're going to get the idea pretty quick.
Well, why don't you start with some autobiography then?
Okay. So I am a Canadian, raised in Canada. I came over here on a temporary job for 3 months, and that was about 35 years ago. So, you know, when I first came here, so what happened, I was working for an engineering firm and we were having these massive layoffs. And they told us that, you know, there's more layoffs coming in the next few months, but there is temporary work in the United States office, you know. So I said, hey, great, you know, I had no connection. So yeah, I was only supposed to be for 3 months, you know. And then the one thing I said, so I'm in Seattle or Bainbridge Island, right? And
A
I made this
beautiful,
out of
beautiful
myself.
area.
Yeah. So I wanted to go see Alaska during that 3 months. And 35 years later, I still haven't gotten up there.
The reason Alaska's so unpopulated, and it's just it's so darn hard to get around to getting there.
No
I mean,
kidding. No
there's
kidding.
only certain points of the year you really want to go.
Yeah. Well, my sister took her honeymoon there, and her husband, they just drove up there in like a regular sedan with a trailer from Vancouver all up that road, you know. So if you want to, you can.
There's just so much of
Yeah.
it. Well,
Yeah.
where you tell me about the home you were raised in.
Well, you're kind of typical, miserable, dysfunctional, middle class, you know, family. I'm sure we all have those same stories, you know. I guess, you know, I mean, I don't want to get too deep into it. You know, I don't want to bore people, but yeah, it's interesting, you know. My parents, they just, I thought they hated each other. And they certainly put on a great, you know, simulation of it. But I remember I was just looking through some old family photos and I saw a photo of them and I just realized, you know, they were perfect for each other, you know. They were, if they just had a little bit more luck and a little bit more courage, it could have been one of the great marriages of all time, you know.
Oh,
But of
man.
course, it just flipped right over to the opposite.
Oh.
Just became, you know, your, like I said, your standard issue hellscape for me and my brother and sister, you know, and them too, you know.
They stayed together, though.
Well, it was weird. So what happened when I was about 15 or 16, my father told us that so we lived in Montreal at the time, right? I think I said that. And he told us that he had been temporarily transferred out to Edmonton. So he was going to be there for the time being. And we all just took it, you know, on face value. And I was going to go out there for the summer. My brother left a few months before I did, traveled west with him, and then I flew out afterwards. So when I got off the plane, my dad picks me up and he says, by the way, I'm actually moved out here permanently and I'm living with my girlfriend, and you're about to meet her in 5 minutes.
Oh.
Yeah, you know, and for me at the time, right, and what I was thinking was like, this is so cool. I can't wait to get back and tell all my friends about this, you know. I'm a 16-year-old guy, right? But what wasn't so much fun, so my brother, who was about a year and a half younger than me, my dad had said, well, we'll drive out to Edmonton together. And he had been looking forward to this for like 6 months, you know, gonna spend 3 weeks on the road with my dad. This is gonna be fantastic. So he picks my brother up. They turn the corner, literally, you know, half a block turn the corner, and there's his girlfriend and her 10-year-old daughter.
Truth is stranger than fiction. I
Yeah,
mean,
I know.
you could a good writer could take something like this and,
Right. Yeah. So, and like my brother, as far as he's concerned, my dad is temporarily in Edmonton. Here's a great vacation, you know. So he finds out that whole thing in 30 seconds, you know, as a troubled, very troubled 14-year-old. You know, I guess he would have been 15 at this time. And then he gets to spend the next 3 weeks in a car with the two of them. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, put me in solitary in a penitentiary somewhere. I mean, that's worse.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Just
Absolutely. Because
complete
what are you going to do?
torture.
How are you going to process that? You know, how are you going to work through those feelings? You know. So I guess more than anything, Ari, if you want that snapshot that gives you the tone.
Yeah, that's a that snapshot says a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how did you survive this?
You know, I think we all have our different strengths and weaknesses, you know. And for me, I think it was a combination. You know, I think just naturally I'm an interior directed person, you know, and I'm relatively strong that way. And then, of course, being in that situation, it's like, this is exactly where I want to be, is on the inside. So it just got reinforced, you know, that's what I was. And looking back, you know, after 60 years, you know, I'm realizing the incredible cost that I have paid for that, you know, because everything you're putting here, you're taking away from over there, you know. And when you're 20, 30, even 40 years old, you have enough vitality that you don't see it. But then into the 50s and now into my 60s, realize what was being weakened and broken and atrophied all those years, you know.
What was your adult relationship like with your parents?
So my dad, you know, when we grew up, right, we thought of him as just this larger than life monster, you know. And then me in particular, you know. So what happened, you know, it's just, you know, if we're going to get into the autobiography, let's get into it. So he realized very quickly that he was way in over his head married to my mother, right? They had my older sister. He was miserable. And then he figured, well, gee, maybe having another kid will save the marriage. You know, classic great ideas.
There's a tried and true
Yes.
solution.
You know, if it worked all these other times, so then I came along. So now, not only didn't it work, but now I was the anchor, totally locking him in, you know. So I didn't realize it at the time because you're a kid, right? You got nothing to compare it to, but I was the one who got the brunt of it, you know, from him, you know. So as I said, you know, like I saw him, and we all did, you know, it's just because he's a very, very intelligent man, you know. Like back then, he skipped two grades, you know. In some ways, formidable mind, and in other ways, very weak, you know. And the thing that I didn't realize until I was an adult, his problem was that he was just too kind, you know. He didn't have what it takes to deal with the actual world as it exists. You know, I remember reading this story in World War II in the Polynesian Islands. And there was this tribe, and they were like among the most peaceful people the world has ever known. You know, there was no word for murder in their, you know, in their culture, because the concept just didn't occur to them. But eventually, inevitably, as World War II swept across, they got dragged into it, and they got caught up in it. And they became the most ruthless, barbaric, bloodthirsty killers that anybody had ever seen.
Wow.
Because they never learned how to deal with it.
Yeah.
Right? Going from this utter, I don't want to say it's artificial, because it wasn't artificial, but nevertheless, you know, that's just not how human nature is.
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden, all of this stuff is coming up. And that was my dad. You know, he just couldn't handle it. So he went the other way.
But then finally he breaks out, he
in the most cowardly,
anymore.
Weak way you can think of, but he did. So this is when I was 16 and my parents didn't divorce until I was 35. Yeah. You know, he's living on the other side of the country, you know. And it was just because he met somebody else that he wanted to marry. He broke up with his girlfriend, met somebody else. She wanted to get married. So in order to get married, he finally had to divorce my mom. Yeah. It'd be extraordinary if it wasn't so ordinary.
Yeah, exactly.
So average.
Yeah, no, that's right. It would be unbelievable if you just didn't see permutations of it all over the place anyway.
Exactly.
But when you just sort of put it there in stark contrast to the bright sunshine, it's like,
yeah.
And then to be a product of this family. And of course, as a kid, in a sense, you're innocent of the audacity of the whole thing, because it's all you know.
Right.
It's all you know.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the whipsaw of it, right? Because at first it's just, well, this is what it is to be in a family, right? And not even that, right? This is just what it is to be alive.
Yeah.
And then as you start to become aware of it, it's like, this is incredible. This is, what is going on here?
Yeah.
And then you realize, oh no, everybody is going through this, or at least in this society.
Yeah,
it's going like this. So in a way, it's like I've come back to, the origin point.
Yeah,
you know,
the 3 weeks, 3 week when you're anticipating an awesome road trip with your dad.
Yeah,
from Alone Montreal to Edmonton, and you turn the corner, and oh, here's dad's girlfriend and her 10-year-old daughter, and we're gonna be in the car for. Oh, it's just unthinkable.
What makes it Shakespeareanly tragic, the whole thing, it's like most families, one of the kids is just this star, this shining star. And that was my brother.
Oh.
Just this beautiful soul, and the thing that made him so beautiful is the thing that was his downfall. He could just never put up that armor. He could never figure out how to shield himself. So every wound he just took, full on. Yeah.
Wow. That's quite a story to introduce. Yeah. I mean, talk about that's.
Yeah. So now you got me on a roll.
Go for it.
So my brother died young.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Yeah. I could get into a story about that. Well, I might as well. Let's go for it. So he joined the Navy to get out of finishing high school. So he was in the Navy since he was 17. Now, what we found out later is he had been an essentially functioning drug addict since he was 12 years old.
Oh.
And in the Canadian Navy, one difference between the Canadian Navy and the American Navy is they have alcohol on the ships. It's essentially free. It's not technically free, but it's essentially free.
And this is to help performance?
Well, I mean, so Canada is the British tradition, right? And there's the British Navy, and you're going back, 500 years, and try and overcome that tradition, even if you realize it was a dumb idea. What are you going to do about it now? So he was never unfunctional, but yeah, he was essentially a drug addict, alcohol, an addict basically.
Yeah.
The whole time. And he had So there was this thing where the bottom of your spine doesn't completely close. It's a genetic defect, right? So essentially what you have is technically an open wound an inch from your asshole, from your anus, you know? So while he was in the Navy, he got surgery to fix it, right? To sew it up. And my sister, who was a trained nurse, right, a registered nurse, was asking him about it. He says, "Well, how often are they changing the dressings?" And he says, "Once a day." And my sister, I mean, literally, like jaw-dropping thing, her jaw literally dropped. And she said, "That's insane. You should be changing that dressing like six, seven, eight times a day." And he says, "Well, what can I do? It's, you know, it's a VA, the equivalent of a VA hospital. This is what they're giving me." And she says, "I will come out to Victoria and stay with you, and I will change the dressings. Just let me do it." But my brother, you know, he's always a fatalist. He says, "Well, no, there's nothing I can do, nothing I can do." So, of course, eventually it got infected and he went septic. So he calls up my sister. What we found out at the time, he had like 105 degree fever. He's hallucinating as he's talking to my sister, and she is like literally freaking out, right? I mean, like losing her mind because she understands her brother might be close to death. And she's trying to do everything she can to get him to the hospital. But to him, you know, especially in his state, she's just the bossy, pushy older sister. So she's freaking out. So what she does is she calls up her best friend, who's also a nurse, and has Ellen call up my brother. And then he listened to her. So he goes into the hospital and ends up spending the next year in the hospital because it had gone septic, you know. And the nurse was saying, yeah, he was like, if it had been another 2 hours, he would have been dead. And what they gave him for that was just, you know, when you get the morphine drip, and you administer it yourself. So for a year, he was on morphine. So he goes into the hospital with the infection that they caused, you know, as I will fully admit, you know, a functional addict, but goes out a full-blown junkie,
Yeah.
you
Yeah.
know, ends up on heroin, you
Yeah.
know, and he's still in the Navy at this time, you know. So he went through about three or four bouts of rehab, you know, which is
Yeah.
standard, right? I mean, I think the average is what they say, seven times,
Yeah.
you know, until it
Yeah.
finally
Yeah.
hits.
Yeah.
You know? And after the fourth time, he pretty much got it kicked, you know. But every once in a while, you know, he would just
Yeah.
have these urges. And what he would do is he'd just go off to a hotel somewhere out of town because he didn't want anybody to know.
Yeah.
And he had taken some cocaine,
Yeah.
had a heart attack, and died.
Oh.
Yeah. And then my sister was talking with a therapist friend of hers and relating this story. And then the friend just gets this, like, you know, this sinking look in her face. And she goes, "I know what happened." My sister goes, "What?" She says, "What happens is when you're in the midst of your addiction, is a toxin like any other toxin, right? And then what your body does is it tries to get rid of the toxins as best it can. And when it's so overloaded, it says, well, I'm just going to put them into the joint tissue because there's no blood flow there, right? So it's the least, you know, it's the safest place. If you cannot get rid of it, it's the safest place to put it. So you build up all these drug residues in your joints. But then what happens is when you kick the addiction and now you start getting better, then, you know, it's a metaphor, but you know, your
Starts
body
leaching out
says
into
to
the rest of
itself,
your
right?
system
Because your body
again.
says, oh, now I can get rid of it. So
Right.
I can flush this back into the bloodstream where now you get these cravings and you don't understand them. You just think you're this weak asshole of a person.
Yeah.
You don't understand it. This is just physiological.
Yeah.
And he couldn't kick it,
Yeah.
you know. And then the problem is, what was this totally mediocre dose when you were doing it every day
Yeah.
is now, and you have no idea of knowing this, now it's enough to kill you.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Well, how did you survive all this? I mean, you're still here. You're sounds like you're in your 60s. You've held down a job. You're living in a very nice place in the United States. You're having a reasonable conversation. You haven't been taken out yet.
Well, as I said, you know, I wouldn't describe it as armor, but for both good and for bad, for great and for terrible, my connection to the physical material world, you know, like that's that cliche, spirits living in the material world, that's me, you know. So the things that would destroy him, it's like, I don't even really notice, you know. And if I did, it's like, who cares? It's just a thing that happened, you know? So like when my dad would do this stuff, it's like, well, it's just a thing that he did, right? It's going to stop at some point, and then who cares, right? And that was good and it was bad, you know? And then also, I'm unlucky in some ways, but in other ways, I just have luck. You know, I have been lucky, you know, things have gone against me, but the big stuff, you know, and it's not like, you know, I won the lottery,
yeah,
but I've avoided disaster.
Yeah.
You know?
Did your family go to church at all? Was.
No, not at all. Not at all. You know, so my religious connection. So when I was about 10, maybe, that sounds about right, in order to have some peace and quiet on Sunday mornings, you know, ostensibly it was to give us a religious education, but the real thing was get the hell out of the house for a few hours.
Yeah.
You know, and there was a Baptist church at the end of the street, you know, and for no other reason than that was the only one in town.
Right.
Went to a Baptist church for a few years. And at the time, you know, Baptist, Catholic, you know, Anglican, it would have made no difference to me.
Right, right. As long as they have a Sunday school that basically gives free childcare and the parents exactly. have a degree of confidence that nothing horrible is going to happen to the children when they're over there, because
yeah.
well-meaning people are, no matter how, whatever they believe, the details of their belief, they're, you know, they've got some desire to give these children stories from the Bible about Samson and David and Jesus.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, so that lasted about 2 years or so, you know, and then, you know, when you hit puberty, right, it's like, you know, I'm not going to take this shit anymore. And I didn't. You know? But now I can get out of the house for other reasons. So it was no longer a problem for them, you know.
Right, right, right.
And then when I was about 15 or so, you know, looking back on my life, I can see I was always, depending on how you want to look at it, fascinated or obsessed with just the nature of God.
Yeah.
Even as a kid, you know, there's just some people who have that temperament.
Yeah.
You know? And I was one of those people.
Yeah.
You know, so I went back into it for a few years, and then I ran into some people. Most people would consider it a cult. It's called the Church of Bible Understanding.
Huh, never heard of them.
Yeah, it's a small one. It was out of Philadelphia. And then Stuart somebody or other. I can't remember the guy's name. And, you know, it was a classic thing. They just had some communes in various cities. And I fell in with this group of people, you know. And then that lasted for about a few years. But, you know, it's like I tell people, you know, the most withering, you know, for the vast majority of my life, the most withering insult I can level against somebody is to call them a joiner, you know. It's like that was the lowest of the low. So that didn't work itself out too much.
Yeah.
You know, and by 2021, you know, I wouldn't say it was an agnostic. I'd just say it was like, it was way on the back burner.
Okay.
You know, it was like 37th on my list of priorities
yeah,
to
yeah,
deal with.
Yeah.
You know, And that's where I've spent most of my life until very recently in that place.
So what prompted the change very recently? What happened?
Well, there's been a number of steps that have happened along the way. You know, so my sister, she became a very devout Christian, you know, essentially like non-denominational Protestant, but
yep.
It is absolutely the focus of her life.
And does your sister live in Canada or the United States?
Lives in Canada.
Okay.
Yeah. So we all started off in Montreal and everybody migrated westward. So there, you know, the rest of them are in BC. I'm in Seattle. So we were visiting, this is about maybe 15, 20 years ago, and we were having this conversation where she was telling me about, you know, how there's just something special about Christians, or just something about different about Christians. And then the thought came to me, it says, you know, it's like human nature. You look at inspiring, extraordinary Christians, and then you look at average, ordinary people from every other faith, and then you say, oh, there's something special about Christians. And, you know, and as you can imagine, that brought the conversation to an end right quick, you know. So I was thinking to myself, though, after the fact, in the days afterwards, this is, well, great, David, you took that away from her. But what did you have to give her back? What did you have to replace it with?
Mm.
You know? I mean, it's easy to tear stuff down.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So it just got me thinking, well, what do I think? You know, if not that, then what?
Yeah.
You know? So that was kind of like the first step on the, you know, or maybe even a pre-step. And what I came to at the time, and my thinking has certainly expanded since then, but it still includes this. You know, when we think of God as, you know, as a first draft, as a heuristic, you know, we think of God as being infinite,
yeah.
Certainly compared to us.
Yeah.
You know, we are these finite creatures, and here is this infinite essence. So I was thinking about, okay, what is the ratio of, you know, any finite quantity to infinity? You know, and then meaningfully, it's undefined. It's a mystery.
Right.
But in practical terms, there is no quantity closer to zero than the ratio of my understanding to God.
Right.
You know, so it doesn't make a difference how wise I am. It doesn't make a difference how much I understand. I know as much about God as, you know, a drunken atheist. You know, we're all in the same boat. And then I was thinking, well, that doesn't, you know, that's kind of gloomy. You know, where do you go from there? And then I was thinking, well, God is infinite, but the path he laid out for me is not.
Yeah, yeah. You know,
that's something just for me.
Yeah.
And that I can certainly at least grab a hold of. And then what occurred to me is that's all I can ever know. You know? And then kind of where it came from that is like, it's not even so much that I can know the path. Like 95% of it is I know when I'm off the path. You know? And most of the time, almost all of the time, that's good enough. You know, as long as I'm in a place where I'm not certain I'm off the path, things are probably going well. You know, so I went through that for a few years. And then a few years later, so my semi-agnosticism, it was certainly based in Christianity. You know, just because I'm a man, you know, I'm a product of the West, right?
Yep. How can it not be?
Right. You know, so, you know, Christ is the God I don't believe in. I'm going to not believe in any other God. I'm going to not believe in Christ. So it was at the time, I think it was the Dugars.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And when that scandal blew up where the brother, you know, was molesting his sisters.
Yeah.
So there was an online article, and it was a woman who had been raised in that spirit, right? That kind of fun, you know, that particular flavor of Christian fundamentalism.
Yeah.
You know, with that absolutely the man is the head and the woman is there to serve the leadership.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is she had a very, very happy childhood, right? It was not problematic. It was not traumatic.
Yeah.
Her parents were loving.
Yeah.
But when she hit like 18 or 19, whatever, and they said, you know, you should go to college. And, you know, if this is the life for you, you should choose it. You know, so you should see other things. So she did. And then realized, well, this isn't for me. So she didn't go back to that life. But she was explaining this or giving her take on it. And the one thing she said is, you know, the way these people talk, these extremists talk, that's straight from the Bible. That's what it says to do. They just take it literally.
Yeah.
You know, what the vast majority of people do is they give it lip service.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that might have been a little bit unfair.
Yeah.
But essentially, so they give it lip service and then go and live their lives the way essentially everybody else does anyways.
Yeah.
You know, and then at the time, and my thinking has moved on from this point, but it was kind of a milestone. Reading that, I was thinking, yeah, you know, that point makes sense to me. And then what hit me says, you know, for this one thing, the Bible is just wrong. They are just wrong about this. They got the relationship between men and women wrong. You know, I was, you know, like Iroquois society, the way Iroquois society is functions, you know, that seems a lot more like the relationship between men and women. That seems a lot closer to me. You know, where there are definitely roles, you know, there's definitely the female roles, there are definitely the male roles, and a lot of them are even kind of standard what we would think of, but the power is definitely equal. I mean, these are partners. And then what that led me to believe is, well, if the Bible is just flat out wrong, then there goes the foundation for it, you know. And as I've said, in the years since, I don't think that way anymore. But it certainly was a turning point, you know. And then the next step was just, you know, I had dabbled with Buddhism. And, I mean, obviously, you know, ageless wisdom and beauty and profoundness, but it just didn't resonate. And then just related to it, I was in a bookstore and I just ran across, you know, in the shelves, a translation of the Tao Te Ching and just started thumbing through it. And, you know, I mean, at least for me, it's absolutely in no way is this a religious text. It's not a religious spirit. It's just, you know, it's basically a handbook, you know, a practical guide. But looking at that just instantly, you know, within 15 seconds of reading it, it's like not even knowing what the hell they were talking about. It's like, this is it. This is what I've been looking for, you know, and that's 25 years, you know, that's come to me. And, but then, so the proximate cause, what got me to where I'm at right now, when Trump got elected, and I was as big a Trump hater as anybody.
You know, on Bainbridge Island, I mean, it's, I would imagine Bainbridge Island, you can put up a cathedral to Trump hating.
Yeah, without a doubt. Without a doubt. But, you know, I mean, when I get into work, right, I'd be bored and I just, you know, be surfing the internet. Any, you know, let's hate on Trump story, I was there.
Yeah.
You know? My favorite pastime, when I would show up first thing in the morning to work, and I always shut up before anybody else so I could screw around for a while. So what was that website with Nate Silverman?
586, something like that, a number.
Yeah. So they had the popularity chart.
Yeah.
And it was over the entire course of his presidency.
Yeah.
But you could zoom in to like where you're looking, you know, Tuesday versus Monday.
Right.
So what I would do is I'd take my mouse cursor and I'd just go back and forth between like one or two days, like 20 times in a row. It goes like from 39.9% popularity to 39.7 popularity.
Yeah, it didn't change that much the whole time, which was interesting. Right.
But it's just feeding something in me, you know?
Yeah.
You see, like, you know, if his popularity would rise by 0.1%, I'd be, you know, in the depths of desolation, and it would go down by 0.1%. I'm a bullion. Like, oh, yes. And I do this every day. Every day I would be doing this. But it was by the beginning of the last year of his presidency. And just all of a sudden, I went into, I don't think it's too much to say it was a spiritual crisis.
Huh.
You know, because it's just, you know, like you'll be in the middle of something and then something will happen. You'll just look around, you know, or even better, you know, if you're walking down the street and then all of a sudden there's a mirror there that you weren't expecting to see. So you catch the sight of this complete stranger. And it felt like that.
Huh.
I just looked around at myself and at the whole country. And it is everybody on every side consumed with hatred. You know. And my daughter would have been 12 or 13 years old, you know, and she is a star in the way that I was talking about my brother, just this shining, beautiful, just open, generous, guileless, you know, pure spirit. And just the image, you know, the world, you know, with its devouring maw. Just turning to her, saying, fresh meat.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, I was like in despair.
Mm.
And, you know, what am I going to do? Where am I going to go? And I had no idea whatsoever. You know, so one guy that a friend had turned me on to, it's amazing. It's like YouTube, the YouTuberverse, you know. So this friend of mine had turned me on to Douglas Murray.
Oh.
You know, so yeah. I've been watching, you know, and I'd already been, you know, a Jordan Peterson fanatic, right? And now here comes the next one. So I'm watching a Douglas Murray interview, and then there's the sidebar, right, of all the other ones. So here's a guy who was reviewing the latest book by Douglas Murray. But okay, I'll click on that. And have you ever heard of Rabbi Jonathan Sacks?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was him.
Oh, right. He reviewed a Douglas Murray book.
He did.
Interesting.
He did. Actually, there was two books that he was reviewing. And this was one of them. It was like compare and contrast deal.
Huh.
So listening to his review, it's like, I didn't even care about the book.
Yeah.
But just here is this wisdom that's 10,000 years old.
Yeah.
You know? And it's like, what is this? So immediately, of course, you know, Jonathan Rabbis, you know.
Yeah, you do it on YouTube.
Exactly. Yeah. And then go to his website, which has all of those. I know there's a name for it. I can't remember the name. But it's just flat out sermons, you know, that he would give. And there's like about, 150 of them.
Hmm.
And I just started. So I went all the way back to the number one, the first one, and just started going through them, you know, and it's like, here is the voice of a man of God, you know, here is the wisdom, you know, is it his wisdom? Is it God's wisdom? I don't even care at this point.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, that's what's been missing. Mm. That's what's missing from my life. That's what's missing from the world, you know. God is missing, you know. So I was actually even thinking about, going to a synagogue, but I don't know how good of a fit that would be. So I was talking with a friend of mine whose ancestors were Quakers. And I used to tell him that was the only thing that I was jealous of him or envious of him about. And I knew nothing more about Quakers than the Quaker Oats, which is pretty cool. It's a pretty cool look. And to be honest, it was like, if you're going to join a club, you might as well join the cool club. And this was the cool club for me. So I managed to hook up with a group of Quakers on Bainbridge Island.
I would imagine they'd have some Quakers on Bainbridge Island. That sounds like a kind of a place where you could find some Quakers.
And then thinking that I found the answer, and turned out, well, no, there's just the mirror image. But nevertheless, there's the, if you're going to connect to God, you have to do it through people. And we're all just humans. So the last 2.5 years has been trying to work through, and those pieces that I sent you, that's me trying to work through my own shit. Because there's something like where it started, because I'm not a writer. Prior to that, that's the first time in my life I have ever written something that wasn't, I had to write it, or I'm writing a letter to somebody. That's the first time I've ever written anything. So there was this document that was being circulated through all the Quaker churches for their approval. So of course it got sent out to us. It was the Quaker Statement on Immigration. Okay, fine, I'll read this. And it was the most asinine, shallow load of gibberish, mean-spirited gibberish, this
Oh.
judgmental, so
Quakers
basically,
shouldn't be mean-spirited or judgmental. That doesn't
well,
seem
but it's
very
so easy,
Quaker-like.
but it's so easy to put a coat of Brotherhood Unity paint over it. So the basic thesis of this piece was anybody in any part of the country, of the world, for any reason, has a sacred right to immigrate into the United States of America. And yeah, and I'm not, it sounds like I'm just trying to exaggerate and make it sound worse than it is, but no, this is exactly what it was. Not only that, if you try to deport anybody, doesn't make a difference what the reason is. You're a racist, you are a xenophobe. Further than that, if you deny them any service that the government offers, you're a racist and you're a xenophobe and you're taking part in white privilege and colonization. And I'm thinking, you know what, buddy? Your property line is a boundary. Your front door is a boundary. And so we're supposed to discuss this. And like when you watch comedy shows, you can get the guy who doesn't know what to say. It's like, that was me, And I realized, well, what is it I'm trying to say? What am I trying to communicate to these people? So the very first piece, I don't know if you read any of them, but it was the very first piece and a very different form than that. But that was me trying to make sense of what it was I wanted to say, and the interesting experience, when you write something out in longhand, it feels one way, and you just see, the Arial font on a white screen, and all your ideas and your thoughts and your views are just naked and unadorned. It was a transformative experience, and so I've been basically in a conversation with myself, and endlessly repeated. You know, I mean, I would think every piece has been revised at least 100 times.
It's like Peterson's Maps of Meaning book over and over and over again.
Well, speaking of Peterson, okay.
Well, so how on earth do you find me? I mean, we got about 10 minutes left. So your story has been so much fun. I've really enjoyed it.
Okay. But I want to reserve some time for my Jordan Peterson origin story. But okay. So how I found you is just, you know, YouTube sidebar hell, like, you know, you're just finding, you know, it's just what shows up on the algorithm.
Yeah.
Sooner or later, you know, with the kinds of stuff I, you know, Glenn Lowry, Andrew Sullivan, Douglas Murray, Jordan Peterson, you know, eventually, of course, you're going to end up there sooner or later.
And poor you clicked.
And interested right from the beginning, you know, and then early on, you know, I mean, I came across a thing where you said, hey, let's have a talk.
Yeah.
And it was always in the back of my mind.
Yeah.
But I don't even know why, but in the last 4 or 5 months, when you, you know, I've been watching something, you said, like, this conversation was really fascinating to me.
Yeah.
And when you would say this, say, okay, fine, let me go listen to the actual conversation. And it's like, every time it's like, wow, this is an amazing conversation. So, you know, not trying to brown nose or anything, but something, you know,
yeah,
because it just happened over and over and over again. There's never been a time when it's like, no, I don't get it. You know, so that kind of ramped it up. It's like, this is somebody I would like to talk to. I was hoping to not have a monologue about it, but you get what you get.
No, I loved it. I mean, I'm.
Yeah, I would like to hear more from you, but nevertheless.
You know, you hear lots from me. I get to talk into the YouTube a lot. So
yeah,
I don't get as much chance to hear back. And your stories have just been, this is why I do these randos conversations, because the world is such an incredible place and filled with so much glory and tragedy. You've brought
and
both to the table.
They're inseparable.
Today.
You don't get one without the other.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So yeah. So indulge me, please. Let me tell you my Jordan Peterson origin story, because nobody else is interested in it. You know? Okay. So going back to prehistory, right? This will come back later. There was a song in the early 90s called Big Hard Sun by Indio. And you know, there's songs that just like get into your soul
and
never let you go. This was one of them, you know. So for 30 years, this song, I mean, it's still, I well up when I listen to this song. Okay, so that's then. Now moving forward. The Christmas just after Jordan Peterson blew up, right? So most years I spend Christmas by myself. I don't work between Christmas and New Year's, and my wife and daughter go visit family in California, so I'm by myself, which means I watch YouTube videos all day long, you know, for the whole time they're gone. So I got sucked into this, you know, how to screw lots of women websites, you know. So I started watching it, but the guy was fascinating. Because, like, so one of the things he's saying, right, you know, says, well, if you want to get the women,
More interesting than the women, actually.
Well, yeah. So, like, the thing is, like, you know, he'd say things like, you know, like, if you want to get the women, you have to be excellent. You have to be worth something as a man. So you better work on yourself. And I'm thinking, wow, that sounds really great. But then he'd say other stuff. And it was funny, you know, because like about 2 or 3 days into it, I realized, this guy is a full-blown sociopath. Why not? But the interesting thing is, like, the thing about sociopaths and psychopaths, they can look at the world, see things and say things that the rest of us aren't allowed to do. They can see truth that the rest of us are not allowed to see.
Yep.
And that's what fascinates. You know, and of course it wears off pretty quick because it's just toxic, but you know, for that little vibe. Okay, so there's one thread. So now here's the last thread. There was a music website that I really liked, Adam Neely, And he recommended another website by Rick Beato, which is also an amazing website.
Yeah. My friend Rick always is playing Rick Beato videos.
Yeah. Right. So one of the sections he has is what makes this song great.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, the thing that what happens is you listen to a really great episode, and of course you're just thinking, boy, I wish he would do this song. Right. So that's what was happening. Now I come back to Big Hard Sun. Right. I was thinking it would be so great if he would do Big Hard Sun. Now the thing, it was called India. It was, you know, technically it was a band, but it wasn't. It was just one person who assembled these musicians. He did this one album and he absolutely disappeared after that. You never heard from him again. So now, because of watching the Rick Beato YouTube video, I'm thinking about Big Hard Sun, thinking about India. I'm thinking, man, I wonder whatever happened to this guy. So I Google in, whatever happened to Gordon Peterson? I mean, absolutely no idea who Jordan Peterson is. And then my screen just blows up into tsunami of Jordan Peterson video. And I'm thinking to myself, well, is this stupid? And I'm just about ready to just clear the search and look again. One of them is from another one of these How to Lay a Bunch of Women. Because it's like, you know, you have to have this conversational prowess. And what it turned out to be was the Kathy Newman interview.
Oh,
wow. So because of the dating website thing, that's why I clicked on it. Watch this video. And it's like, you know, you get these moments where the world is just a little bit different than it was before you saw that video.
Yep. 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 You know?
And then from there, you know, like for me, Jordan Peterson is always those University of Toronto courses.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's
yeah,
who Jordan yeah. Peterson.
Yeah. Is. That those are the best.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's peak Peterson in many ways.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah.
Just wow. Something, you know, it's like one thing I think about him, I think 300 years ago, he still would have been considered a first-class mind.
Yeah.
But it's just like, we're not there anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
Like years ago, when I was living by myself, there was this used bookstore down the street. And I just started buying all these used books, you know. And I'd buy just like novels, like essentially dime store novels from the 30s and 40s.
Yep.
And this is like I said, totally forgotten writers that never even were. But you read this and it's like this density of thinking, this depth of thinking.
Yeah.
That the most intellectual stuff we have now is like we cannot think the way we used to.
Yeah. No, it's true. I mean, even when you read, let's say, if you're watching Ken Burns' Civil War and just a few of the letters that these are ordinary soldiers writing home. War, and it's like the mastery of the language they had compared to, you know,
and the depth of thought, you know, what they were saying.
Yeah.
You know, like one thing that would frustrate me, you know, when people would talk about Jordan Peterson and even the fans, and they would talk about how smart he was.
Yeah.
And I'd say, no, this guy's, you know, I don't know if you've seen any of the TV Ontario stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he's been thinking about this for 30 years.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the amount of work he put into this.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's where it's coming from.
Yeah, no, that's true.
Yeah.
We only have a few more minutes. I'm sorry. I wish you're obviously a guy I could sit and talk to all day. There's no question about that. Anything? I mean, I don't know. I got this little tradition of sharing conversations. If you want to keep this private, that's totally okay. I mean, you disclosed a lot of stuff, but you sure got some great stories and your life is a great story.
Whatever you want to do is fine with me. You know, I don't believe in secrets. You know, if I want to keep it secret, I just won't say it in the first place.
Oh, that's a good way to be.
Yeah.
But
if you want to use 2 minutes, if you want to use the whole thing, if you don't want to use any of it all, I'm fine. Whatever you want to do is fine with me.
All right.
I didn't come on here looking to be a star, but.
Well, it's funny because on my channel, you know, you can like to. You put a video up about Jordan Peterson or ContraPoints and Tucker Carlson and all kinds of people watch 2 minutes of it. you know, a group of people will watch all of it. But the randos conversations, a few hundred people will look at it. But of those few hundred people, there'll be some that really enjoy it. And because they see in it that there's something just way more true and authentic about normal people sharing their stories. And like a number of the stories you told, the truth is stranger than fiction. It's always has been.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you say that because, you know, since I reached out to you, I've been thinking about you a lot more, right? Obviously.
Sure.
And it's like you think like Jordan Peterson and Douglas Murray, and they're just, I don't even understand where they're coming from. I don't understand how you can think that, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Think those thoughts. And it's like they're freaks of nature in a way.
Yeah.
You know? But then there are just wise, thoughtful people. And the obvious first thing is, well, okay, they're like a diluted version, but it's not true. It's a different thing. Yeah. And they have something that the Jordan Petersons and Douglas Murrays don't have. And thinking of you specifically, yeah, I could listen to you longer than I can listen to them.
Well, thank you.
It's amazing what they say.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, it's like watching a, like in a way, you know, Jim Thorpe impresses me more than Usain Bolt.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
You know, he inspires me more. I want to be connected to that spirit more.
Yeah.
You know, and that's how I see you.
Oh,
well, like, I mean, I articulated that to myself now.
That's very generous. But I think, I mean,
it's true though.
And it is. And you find people, I mean, people are like, oh, I'm not that unique. There are many, many, many wise, wise people out there that this world will never see and never know, but they're all over the place.
Yeah.
And if you just sort of slow down and pay attention and listen a little bit, there they are.
Right. Oh, no, and, I definitely agree with that.
You know,
yep.
You are the salt of the earth, Jesus says. and that's how that phrase has come in our language. They're the salt of the earth kind of people. And they
that's
might not be.
Though, because you salt the earth to destroy it.
I know. Isn't that funny? It's such a strange thing. Well, yeah. I've got another person coming at the top of the hour.
Sure.
And
well,
Dave,
I want to thank you so much. This has been such a great experience.
Oh, this has been wonderful. I've so enjoyed hearing your stories. Thank you so much for being generous enough to share them. And, you know, we should talk again. This has been,
I would love it.
Been terrific. And, maybe, you know, if I've got a daughter who's living up in Seattle right now, and there's a bunch of other randos who are up in Seattle. So, I should really get up there at some point and do a little meetup or something like that. And
oh, that'd be even better.
Meet a bunch of people. So.
I could run into Hoverbond.
All right.
All right.
Great to meet you, David. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.